George Washington and slavery. That's our topic for the next few moments on Focal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Dr. Peter Lilback, a returned guest. He and I had the privilege of co-writing a book together many years ago called George Washington's Sacred Fire, which we believe documents beyond a reasonable doubt that George Washington was indeed a faithful Christian. He was an 18th century Anglican, and to say otherwise is literally to yank him out of his historical context. Dr. Lilback, so great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Jerry. It's always great to be with you and to be with your listeners.
Okay, now we all saw what happened recently in Charlottesville, and there were attempts to bring down Confederate statues. But after that, some have said, well, why not bring down George Washington statues? After all, he owned some slaves. So let's talk about slavery and George Washington.
Okay, well, to begin that discussion, there are several things we should keep in mind. First of all, Washington, as a child who grew up in what we called the Old Dominion of Virginia, he knew slavery from the very moment of his earliest days. He was the fourth generation of Washingtons to have slaves. So it was the cultural milieu in which he grew up. He didn't know anything other than that, so that meant he imbibed perhaps some of the most tragic expressions of chattel slavery. We can actually see that in his early writings. He had a particular slave that was difficult to manage, and he says, take him back to the West Indies, sell him, and whatever you get for him, bring back molasses and limes and maybe some rum and other things. When we read that, we just recoil at moral indignity and say, how could he have felt that way? Well, tragically, that was the way Southern culture had come to see the issue of slavery. But something important happened as the struggle with the Great Britain Parliament and King hit Virginia, and that was the passing of the Fairfax Resolves. And I recall, Jerry, as we spoke about that, we both concluded that was the beginning of Washington assessing, did he like slavery, or was it just inevitable that he had to deal with it? Because, one, it did cut off the importation of slaves, which meant he was following the pattern of breaking off commerce with England in protest for the Stamp Act and other sorts of things coming against the colonies to raise unjust taxes. But he began to wrestle with the issue of, am I breaking up families? Is this a good thing? And so that was the first little glimmer that he was addressing a social problem. But what I think happens over the next several years in his life is that he begins to recognize that slaves could not only fight, because there were slaves that were in the Revolutionary Army, that he was influenced by his connection with Lafayette from France, who had already become aware that slavery was not a moral thing and had actually talked about some efforts he had at possibly ending slavery. And so at the end of the war, now as a private citizen, as a victorious general, he's visited by the Methodist bishops in America. And according to their diary, they said they were talking with Washington about the need to end slavery. And in that discussion, they record in their minutes that Washington said, I'm not in public office, so I have no power to change the law of the land, but I've become convinced that we must work to end slavery. That he recognized that slavery was damaging not only to the people but even to the owners, that it created a moral problem and difficulties in their own communities. So with that in mind, we see then the beginning to really look hard at how would he end slavery. But the really decisive moment comes at the end of his life. He's now, after having been a president, having struggled with the problem of how do you have slaves in a free state because you're part of the federal government that's in Philadelphia, and you have slaves as a Virginian, and he couldn't get people to work for him. And he writes about the moral dilemma that he has, and he finally resolves to solve it, and that is in his last will and testament. George Washington wrote in his last will and testament that all of the slaves that he owned at his wife's death and his death, they would in fact be freed. He provided for their provision and their being freed, and he also mentioned some by name, one in particular, Billy Lee, who was his personal body slave for many years, and he provided for him very generously. And so it has been summed up in the following way. Washington went from being a cavalier slave owner to one who principally struggled with owning slaves to finally saying, I don't want to let my life end as though I'm a slave owner. He freed them. And in the process of that last part of his life, according to the information we have, he began to allow there to be various trades and skills that they would learn in preparation for freedom. They were, in fact, freed. And so George Washington becomes the only slave-owning president America has ever had who freely gave freedom to his slaves without the intervention of the Civil War. Hmm. In other words, Washington is a man of moral character that moves from the blindness of the moral wickedness of this reprehensible slave trade to becoming one who led the way to free his slaves. And I conclude with this. If the other southern plantation owners had followed George Washington's pattern of freeing their slaves by the end of their lives, there never would have been a civil war in America. Mm. It was an extraordinary step in the right direction. So a flawed hero, yes, but nonetheless still a hero. He was able to see how to work through a moral crisis of culture and come out on the right side. I hope we have as much wisdom in our own cultural struggles today.
I once heard that there were 9 presidents of the United States that owned slaves. Washington was the only one who freed them. Apart from the idea of a president freeing his slaves, how common was it of the idea of a man freeing his slaves, you know, albeit at his deathbed? How common was that in that day, in Washington's day?
I don't know that it was all that common. I think it would have been a rather unique step where he was beginning to show the right way forward. But that would be a good study to see what other examples we have. I'm not aware of any other, but my knowledge obviously is limited. But if I can go on a little bit further, I don't know if you want to talk just about Washington, Jerry, but
I'd like to save that for the next segment, because I want to talk about slavery and the founders beyond George Washington. But let's focus on just Washington during this time. And you mentioned the Fairfax Resolves. Those are resolves that came up from within the Virginia legislature, correct? House of Burgesses?
That's my understanding, yes.
1770s. And one of the points in that was that they would stop the slave trade, the importing of slaves. It's my understanding that Great Britain, which controlled America at that time, vetoed those Fairfax Resolves. So here were the colonies in the days before Wilberforce's successful crusade in Great Britain to end slavery because of his Christian convictions. The American colonists, or at least some of them in Virginia, were trying to stop the importation of slaves. I think that's very significant, because sometimes, you know, you hear about the founding father, it's a bunch of dead white guys, and some of them were slave owners.
Yeah, it's a great, great point, and it's sad, if we can put it this way, that we did not have an American Wilberforce that was able to lead a national successful work to end slavery without the bloodshed of the Civil War. That was true in the case of Great Britain, and part of it was because of Wilberforce, the Christian leader, who was very close, obviously, to John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace. He was who himself had been a slave ship captain before he'd become converted. And so a pastor and a legislator actually came together and found a way to change the civilization of the United Kingdom. And one of my friends, who's a great Presbyterian minister from the Southern tradition, said, if the ministers in the South had had the courage to speak against slavery, they could have actually changed history by reminding men that they needed to bring it to an end and not just defend it. But those pastors didn't have the courage to speak against it. Yeah. In fact, preached sermons to support it. So this reminds us then, in the struggle like this, the power of godly moral preaching emanating from the gospel and the scriptures has the ability to bless a nation in many ways. Wilberforce is an example, and with John Newton in England, in preventing a civil war and ending slavery. We didn't have that in the South, and if we had, maybe our history would be much healthier today. We don't know for sure, but slavery ended, obviously, because of the difficulty and the bloodshed of the tragic Civil War.
You know, by the way, we were talking earlier about how common was it, and the answer was basically not very common for a person to just free their slaves in antebellum South, just, you know, based on the biblical principles or whatever, as Washington did. And it's ironic, but it's interesting to note that Robert E. Lee did that, actually, ironically. Yes, that Robert E. Lee, whose statue they're trying to tear down in different places. And they're not just stopping there. Some have actually called for the tearing down of statues of George Washington because he did own slaves, you know, for most of his life. What are your thoughts about tearing down statues of Washington on that front?
Well, I think one of the things I love to say when I bring people to Washington, D.C., and you stand by this gigantic Washington monument, is I say, start at the bottom and just gradually raise your eyes all the way to the top, and do you see a place where the color of the stone changes? And you go about a third of the way up, and all of a sudden you see there's almost like an invisible line where the shade of stone changes from the bottom to the top. And I'd like to say, do you know what that line is? That line is the change from the pre-Civil War Washington to the post-Civil War Washington. They were building the Washington Monument, and the Civil War intervened, and the monument building stopped. Several years after that project of the Civil War coming to an end, they began to build, and they got the stone from a different quarry. And so actually on the Washington Monument, there is a line that identifies the pre-Civil War Washington and the post-Civil War Washington. And I'd like to say that that is exactly the way we need to look at Washington himself. There is a Washington before the ending of slavery in his own life and the Washington after he'd come to the conclusion that slavery needed to end. And that just as you don't look at half of the monument, you must look at all of it. We need to look not just at half of Washington's life, but the whole of his life, and that we don't have to deface the Washington Monument because of his imperfection. In God's providence, there's already a scar on the monument to remind us of the scar in our history. The different colors on the monument remind us of the struggle, the different colors in our racial makeup in America. And it tells us the good story of how what is wrong can be righted. And I think that's why we shouldn't tear down the Washington Monument. And I'd love to think that when Martin Luther King was standing with his great throng of people celebrating what they hoped was a dream of Martin Luther King, this is what he was looking at. He was looking at the context of the Washington Monument, saying the values that one day we hope will be in the future were already laid in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He said that was a cistern that was dug deep, and we're now bringing out those values. Those are words he actually used in his letter from Birmingham jail. It was part of his dream that the very freedoms that our founders fought for would one day be part of everyone. I'd like to say that little line across that statue in Washington, D.C., that gigantic monument, I should say, tells us that story if we have eyes to see. No need to mark it, attack it, take it down. Instead, take a close look and learn, because it's already there.
And, you know, at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is heroes, and they're all flawed except for Jesus Christ. No one is without sin. And so if you really started to just tear down statues, oh, this person's imperfect, that person's imperfect. I mean, at the end of the day, they shouldn't build any statues, you know, and we might as well join the American Taliban here, you know?
Yeah, we should go into the future and say, well, the day is going to come because Martin Luther King was too much of a peaceful person. He did not have enough of a radical spirit. He never taught anyone to use violence. He never taught anyone to tear down statues. He never told anyone to say one race is better than another, and now this is the way we need to deal with it. Get rid of him.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that makes, you could actually say some of the expressions of the racial discord we're facing today actually would be the basis, if they were consistent, of tearing down the Martin Luther King Monument.
Isn't that amazing?
That's absurd.
It is absurd. And at that point, we'll end, but we'll continue this discussion about slavery and the founders, going beyond just George Washington. Dr. Peter Loback, providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you, Dr. Loback. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry. Great to be with you.
Okay.